Welcome to the latest episode of Your Wealth with Gemma Dell, a podcast series designed to help you create, grow, and protect your wealth.
Hi, and welcome to Your Wealth. I'm Gemma Dale, NAB Trade's Director of SMSF and Investor Behaviour. Today I'll be interviewing Adam Fleck from Morningstar Research about his views on the state of the market, the quantitative and qualitative research methodologies Morningstar employs, which stocks are looking cheap and expensive based on their research, and what they're looking out for in today's market. Adam is a chartered financial analyst, which is a brutal qualification undertaken by true market obsessives, and he's now the regional director of equity research in Australia and New Zealand for Morningstar. Before assuming this current role, as you can probably guess from his accent in a minute, Adam was director of North American consumer equity research for Morningstar, covering beverage and tobacco companies, and associate director of equity analysis, covering heavy equipment and other industrial companies. Adam, thanks for joining me.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, Adam, I'm going to point out for our listeners right now, many of whom will already be aware of this, that Morningstar provides the quant research for 180 stocks on the ASX that all NAB Trade investors have access to. So listeners can log into NAB Trade, see the recommendations and research reports we're going to discuss. If you're listening and you're not a NAB Trade customer, you can join online for free, and then you can log in and see the sorts of research that we're talking about. So, Adam, can you start by talking us through your quant research methodology, and if you could loosely describe how you come to the research recommendations you provide, that'd be great.
Absolutely. I'll talk about both the quant research, which I think is a natural segue into the qualitative equity research and the team that I manage as well.
Okay, great.
The quant research, what you'll see is a variety of ratings concentrated really on the quantitative star rating and the quantitative moat rating. Mm-hmm. Both of those are based on what we call a sort of forest-based system, where you're looking at decision trees. And without getting too technical, it's really trying to quantitatively replicate what our qualitative analysts are doing. And then what that means is our qualitative analysts are covering stocks, issuing, as we'll talk about, fair value estimates, economic moat ratings, but we can't cover the entire universe. Mm-hmm. And our quantitative research aims to replicate through a series of decisions what our analysts might look at, mm-hmm. different driving factors, things like multiples or growth rates or health of the company from a financial perspective, and find similar companies that we do cover, mm-hmm. and say, okay, if a Morningstar analyst were covering this company, we think he or she would probably assign it X rating or X moat. And it looks at a variety of different factors and comes to a conclusion based on those different data points. But at the core and the heart of it is really what our Morningstar qualitative equity research team is doing, that then is translated into a quantitative rating.
Okay, fantastic. So one of the more interesting elements of your methodology is the moat rating that you apply. Some listeners will be very familiar with that concept, some won't be. Can you talk us through it and maybe give us some examples of some Australian companies that have a strong moat, or maybe some that really, really don't?
Sure, absolutely. The economic moat is a term that we've borrowed from mm-hmm. Warren Buffett. He does know about it, so we're in his good graces.
Lovely.
The heart of the economic moat theory is measuring the sustainability of a company's competitive advantage. Mm-hmm. Warren Buffett talks about this. If you think about a company's ability to generate high rates of return on the capital, both equity or debt that it's employed, that's the castle. That's really good. Everyone wants a castle. Mm-hmm. Everyone wants high returns on their capital base. But there's besiegers at the gates that mm-hmm. want access to the castle. Mm-hmm. If you have a moat, that's a competitive advantage that can keep those besiegers, that competition, mm-hmm. at bay. For us, return on capital, return on invested capital, is really the gold standard return metric that we're looking at for a company. And we really want to understand, can this company raise capital at some cost? A cost of capital is a term that gets thrown around. Mm-hmm. And then reinvest that capital at high rates of return for long periods. We're talking 10, 20 years. Mm-hmm. If they're able to do that, we think they probably have sustainable competitive advantages and an economic moat. Mm-hmm. There's lots of ways we think a company can do this. Mm-hmm. Things like strong brands, tangible assets like mm-hmm. patents, for instance. Mm-hmm. Sometimes economies of scale can play a part. Switching costs yeah. are a very strong moat driver. Network effect is a great example as well. Mm-hmm. And you know, I think it can really help to talk about specific companies when you start to get into some of these sort of esoteric examples of, you know, okay, you talk about patents, but what does that really mean? You know, you talk about a company like CSL or Cochlear. I mean, these are technological leaders in healthcare that have amazing patents, amazing research and development capabilities. Those are examples of some great companies with moats. You know, certainly businesses with strong brands. You can think about Coca-Cola Amatil here in Australia, for instance, really able to outprice their competition, as well as having economies of scale. They're the biggest player. And network effects are a really, really powerful source. So think about the ASX, for instance. You know, these are companies where firms list on the ASX because they know it has the most liquidity and the most buyers, and buyers want to trade on the ASX because of that liquidity, and they know that the most companies want to list on it. And that's just a really virtuous circle that will build upon itself. So there's lots of examples of companies here with economic moats. And for us, that's really the primary measure when we talk about a company's quality.
Okay. And you factor that into your quant. Would you factor that into quant?
It does factor into quant. And I think it's important that, you know, we're looking again from a quantitative research perspective at similar characteristics of companies. So we'd be looking at things like return on capital, you know, certainly the valuation the market is paying for it. The market tends to value companies with moats at a higher rate, for instance. I mean, it's often no secret that many of these firms are very, very high quality companies. So it looks at a variety of these different characteristics and tries to say, okay, company A that we're trying to assign a quantitative rating to really looks like this grouping of other companies. What is that grouping? Does it share any characteristics from a Morningstar equity analyst perspective, a qualitative analyst perspective, that we can come to a conclusion about its moat rating? Well, if that grouping all has an economic moat, a narrow or wide economic moat, which are really just a measure of our confidence in the sustainability of that, then we're more likely, from a quantitative perspective, the system would be more likely to assign that company a moat rating.
Okay, awesome. So just quickly, the ratings that you apply, can you quickly explain them and how they work for people? So when someone goes in, logs in, has a look at the research, goes, okay, I'm going to look up the ASX, as an example you've just used, or one of the others, what sort of ratings will they see and how would they apply that to their thinking?
Sure. So the two most important that I think are worth looking at are the moat rating from a quantitative perspective. And again, you know, the economic moat rating, we assign one of three ratings. There's a no moat rating, which is really our default when we're, you know, looking at a company. Capitalism works is our basic assumption. And, you know, even companies are able to generate high rates of return for a short period, eventually, again, going back to that analogy, you know, have their doors beaten down by competition, and you see that excess return profile slip back to the cost of capital. A company with a narrow moat, you know, we're confident that that return, excess return profile is likely to remain over the next decade. And a wide economic moat, that's the rarest of the rare. These are companies that we think can sustain, certainly over the next 10 years, but really over the next 20 years, we think it's more likely than not that they're going to see returns higher than their cost of capital. That's, again, really measuring the quality of the company. And I think it's important to remember that there, from our perspective, are kind of two sides to this investment coin. You have the quality of the company, but the second rating would be that star rating. You know, trying to understand what price the market is offering on that stock, and is that a reasonable value to pay? You know, I like to use the analogy of cars. I think we'd all agree that a BMW is generally higher quality than many Holdens, for instance, and not to pick on Australians. I'm from Detroit. I grew up in a GM family. But generally, you know, a base model Holden Cruze is probably not going to have all the bells and whistles as a brand new BMW. But that doesn't mean that you go out and spend $1 million on a BMW 3 Series. Nor does it mean that you wouldn't take a Holden for free.
Yes.
There's a price for everything. And, you know, in the short term, price is what you pay, but in the long term, value is what you get. And I think that's really important to remember, and that's what our star rating's trying to capture is, okay, this is the valuation that we think this stock is worth. Again, either from a qualitative perspective where we're doing cash flow projections and coming to an assigned fair value estimate on the stock, or the quantitative side where we're, again, taking a group of companies that has similar characteristics and saying, this is what we think an appropriate price to pay for this stock is. Then we let the market decide for us whether that's a good value or not. Mm. So that's trading well under what we think that intrinsic value is. Mm. Hey, we think you might be getting a good deal and could enjoy a return on your capital that you're employing, you know, the stock that you're buying, higher than your sort of required rate for the risk that you're taking. So again, more stars and it goes up to five. Mm. Generally means that, you know, if it's four or five, it looks undervalued to us. If it's one or two, could be a great company, could have a wide economic moat, but we think it just looks overvalued right now.
Yeah, nice. Okay. So, Adam, you're clearly pretty new to the Australian markets, but the methodology you use, it's intended to be transferable entirely across different markets around the globe. Love to get your first impressions moving to Australia on the Australian market. What stands out to you about the way Australians invest?
Yeah, look, I think you're right. There is a, from our perspective, a transferable methodology, for lack of a better term. You know, again, in any sort of capitalist-driven society where rule of law holds, you know, you should expect this sort of strategy of investing in projects that have high returns to really be the motivating factor for companies and their management teams, but competition to always be, you know, again, battering down that door. Mm. That's the same as it is here. That's the same as it is in the U.S. Really, you know, we cover 1,500 companies from a qualitative perspective globally. We see the same sort of challenges that companies go through every day. So our economic moat ratings are really meant to be transferable across sectors, across geographies. You know, not surprisingly, Australian investors, much like U.S. investors, have a very strong home bias. Mm-hmm. That can, I think, occasionally get folks into inadvertent trouble. Mm-hmm. And the big issue you see in Australia is really sector concentration. Mm-hmm. You know, the U.S. is a very broad, very deep market for really every different sector. You know, there are many beverage companies I used to cover. There aren't so many tobacco companies anymore. Yeah. I suppose that's probably a good thing. Mm. But, you know, there are many heavy equipment companies and startups and all sorts of niche players. You know, technology comes to mind as another area where there's just a huge swath of new businesses, is, you know, seemingly every day. In Australia, you know, it's 30-something percent financials, you know, 15% mining and metals. And if you were designing an index, I don't think you would probably design it that way. Yeah. You know, if you were trying to benchmark yourself against the ASX 200, it almost doesn't matter what stocks you pick. You know, you really just have to determine if you're over or underweight the banks. Mm. And you know, while that may be important for a portfolio manager who's paid versus their benchmark, for investors like you and me, you know, I'm more worried about my own personal rate of return that I need to live on. And I think that's more important, and that's where you can kind of become more index agnostic and not worry so much about, well, I need to be in the banks because otherwise I'm going to underperform the ASX. There's going to be periods where the banks do well and do poorly. There's going to be periods where BHP do well and do poorly. And, you know, you don't want to be basing your entire strategy on what you think about those six stocks.
Yeah, yes. The other one for us is Telstra. So, sure. So NabTrade investors have an enormous proportion of their portfolios in banks, and Telstra are very, very keen on that. So I was going to ask you whether you think that there's a home country bias that is indicative more of familiarity with the local companies, or whether there are really exciting and differentiated opportunities in Australia, so whether we're just more familiar and therefore we're happy to stay at home. And also in Australia, there are specific tax incentives, right, to invest in Australian companies rather than global companies. And they're the reasons we tend to overweight our portfolios to domestic equities. Or do you think that there are certainly opportunities in Australia where Australia has a competitive advantage and therefore our companies do as well?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. You know, there's a lot to unpack there, obviously, but... you know, look, there's nothing, I can understand the home bias. You know,
it's in every market.
It's in every market. You know, it's unfair to signal out Australia and frankly the US because you see it in every market. And frankly, every system is set up for that. You know, it's certainly becoming much easier to invest internationally, but there's additional costs, there's additional tax consideration, there's frankly more paperwork. Mm. And in some cases it, you know, you know, minor things like conference calls being overnight here.
Yeah.
You know, little things like that can add up to a sort of enough friction that there's you know, a natural home bias. There are certainly some areas where Australia is a world leader in, don't get me wrong. BHP and Rio are among the lowest cost miners in the world. You know, we talked about CSL and Cochlear, really world leaders in technology and medical R&D. You know, the some of the certainly the airports that are in our region. You think about Sydney Airport, for instance, and you could throw Auckland Airport into this mix as well. Some of the most profitable, well-run airports, you know, that we see. So there's a lot to like in the Australian market. I think it's just important, you know, from our perspective, to remind folks that, you know, it doesn't have to always be Australia first. Yeah. And, you know, again, it can sometimes get you into a little bit of trouble. If you look, for instance, at the grocery store stocks, you know, you look at Woolworths and I suppose Wesfarmers, you know, being part of Coles, you know, the margin of those businesses you probably would have called world leading at one point, but there wasn't really any barrier to entry that have opened up that market to low-cost players like Costco and Aldi. So, you know, it's, I think, important to understand where, again, the sustainability of those competitive advantages are present and where it really is just sort of a regional situation that, frankly, hasn't received the attention from global players. Like, for instance, if you look at JB Hi-Fi now and Harvey Norman, the challenges they're having with the advent of e-commerce, particularly Amazon, that's really hurt their pricing, hurt their margins. You know, there was nothing unique about Australia's shores that would prevent Amazon from coming here.
Yes.
It just
chose not to.
They just chose not to. So, you know, for us, that's why I think it's really important to focus on and why we focus on, okay, yes, Australia is far away. I've flown back to the U.S. many times. I understand how far away it is. But
you have a personal feel for that?
Yes, but and doesn't always receive the attention maybe we all think it should from some of these players, and it can be really easy to become complacent, I think. But we try to measure that sort of competitive advantage, you know, and understand, okay, is this just time that's going to happen, or is there a true barrier to entry here because of things like, again, brand or patents or some other driver of a moat?
That's quite powerful, because I think, you know, 5 or 10 years ago, people would have felt that there were wide moats on some of the companies you've mentioned without appreciating that those can, that they may appear to be quite wide, but they evaporate really fast when the world changes and technology advances quite dramatically. So you provide research ratings that people can look up anytime. Take us through a couple of the companies that you really like in Australia right now, or that have positive ratings from your perspective.
Sure, absolutely. You know, one that I would highlight is an interesting business. It's one of our few wide moat businesses that we cover here in Australia, and that's InvoCare. You know, it can be a bit of a difficult subject to talk about, of course. They're in funeral care. But from our perspective, they're really clearly the market leader in that business, you know, have fantastic brand awareness, primarily through their White Lady funeral home business, and just a market share that dominates that industry nationally.
So if investors were unaware,
yes.
What does that look like?
They have something like 40% market share.
Right.
And I think the next closest player is in the single digits.
Yes, right.
So, you know, in a business where word of mouth and relationships with families is such a important driver of what leads a loved one to choose a funeral home, you know, that's a really powerful driver and an intangible asset that we think drives a wide economic moat. This is an interesting one because you can pair that quality of the business with the quality of the stock. Recently, the company has, you know, gone through a number of acquisitions. They've been buying up a number of other funeral homes to continue to hold on to that market dominance. But they've, you know, arguably, you know, not invested as much as they should have in keeping up appearances on some of the kind of facilities. Now they're sort of pulling some of those offline, going through a big refurb cycle, and that's going to hit the near-term earnings and cash flow of that business. The market does not like that. The market doesn't like uncertainty. The market doesn't like promises for cash flow later that sacrifice cash flow now. So the stock has been absolutely punished. We think this is temporary. We think this is not even really cyclical. This is a pretty counter-cyclical business, but really just a short-term factor that sets them up well for the future, and we think growth can return to that company. And as a result, right now, you know, the stock has traded off substantially, but we think there's a decent margin of safety, meaning that, look, if we're wrong, you know, the downside case here is that they take them off, they maybe have some challenges, or they lose some of those relationships with families that then go to a competitor and might go to a competitor for a generation. We think the market is pricing that in already and therefore is offering, you know, a higher rate of return for the risk that you're taking.
That's a great example. It's not one we talk about often for obvious reasons. I think it's a difficult topic for people to think about personally, and therefore even financially they're not so enthusiastic to discuss it. And a couple of companies you don't like so much. You've given some good examples in the past.
Yeah, it's we'll go from a very interesting niche player to probably the largest, among the largest in Australia, and that's BHP and Rio. You know, we have been bearish on BHP and Rio, and look, it has certainly moved against where we would have expected that to be, but that has only made us more negative on the long-term future, primarily for iron ore prices and coal prices. Look, we have a lot of respect for BHP and Rio, as we talked about, from a cost position, from an operating cost position. They are among the world leaders in being able to mine iron ore, coal, and get it to the right markets. But that isn't everything if you're, again, pricing in a substantially higher revenue number than what we think is likely. And the biggest challenge that we see for these businesses going forward is that we're pretty pessimistic on where iron ore price is going to be 3 to 5 years from now.
What's your thinking behind that?
Yeah, the biggest thinking behind that is what happens in China. So China dominates steel consumption globally. It dominates, as a result, iron ore consumption at an even higher rate. And we think that China's steel consumption is likely to fall over the next 5 years. There's several reasons for that, but the biggest factors are, while China continues to urbanize, there's simply a lower growth rate as even the same number of people urbanize, that's on a higher base number. So slowing urbanization. And then another big factor is the fact that China, and frankly what has surprised us, China has taken on a just tremendous amount of debt to invest in capital projects over the past couple years that have been very low returning. So the amount of investment they've had to make to generate the same level of GDP growth has been much, much higher. That can't continue forever. So they're taking on a lot of debt. They're seeing their urbanization rate slow. And frankly, the more they pull forward, steel's a really interesting commodity. The more you pull forward and put into the systems, in cars, in infrastructure, in buildings, in houses, the more that will become eventually available to create new steel. The leading markets, developed markets, have about 12 to 13 million metric tons of steel per capita. China's already at about 7.5.
Wow.
There's a certain point where you just don't need more steel.
Yeah, don't even need so many buildings.
You only need so many buildings. And, and again, the important thing is that those buildings eventually get torn down and then recycled into new steel, which you don't need iron ore for. And that's really that effect we think is going to continue to flow through. So as much as China has been pulling forward some of that demand, it really just kicks the can down the road. So that's why we remain pretty bearish, and we think iron ore, you know, in the next 5 years is likely to get back to about $40 per ton versus, you know, over 60 right now.
And the impact for BHP and Rio is not looking too flash on that front.
No, that's right. And you know, the big unknown for those companies as well is the supply response. You know, we're already starting to see some mid-sized miners start to invest in growth again. BHP and Rio, to their credit, have been very, very disciplined. You know, looking at things like share buybacks is a little bit concerning, again, just given where we see the share price. But these companies have traditionally invested very, very pro-cyclically. Mm-hmm. So they've gone out when prices are high and build new capacity, which then, of course, can bring prices back down. That's one thing we're watching very, very closely is to understand, okay, you know, we have our opinion on demand, we have our opinion on supply. It can really drive a lot more cyclicality even beyond that if you start to see BHP and Rio start to invest in growth again.
Fantastic couple of examples, and I think particularly relevant for our investor base who, while they may not trade heavily in those stocks as much in the margin as they do some of the financials, for example, they certainly hold them. Couple of risks you see on the horizon domestically and then also globally. You've got some thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, beyond the risk of commodity price fluctuations, which of course has a major impact on the Australian economy, we continue to watch very closely the housing market in Australia. I have learned that discussing housing is like discussing religion, so I have to be very careful here.
Yeah, it's different to the US. That was the one thing that you can't say to people without expecting strong opinions.
Well, it was very similar prior to 2008. We had a small blip in 2008 in
the US. Yes. Yeah, we try not to think about that here.
No,
we
hope think that's likely to happen. Look,
we won't have the same experience, right?
No, we remain, I think, reasonable in our outlook for housing. We expect, we frankly think it's healthy that, you're starting to see a flattening in house prices. Affordability has become a real challenge, and I don't think that's a secret.
No, the Reserve Bank saying that quite openly.
Absolutely. So, we think that that's relatively healthy. The big concern, of course, is if APRA and the Reserve Bank and regulators are called to action and end up over-regulating, which can then create a downward spiral. If you see, some of the credit growth numbers turn to negatives, for instance, and then people start selling their homes or they need to sell them at significantly lower prices, then it creates challenges for, the bank's loan books, and that becomes really, really ugly. And that starts to not only impact the bank shareholders, but frankly, the rest of the general economy as well. We think the APRA gets it. We think the Reserve Bank gets it. We hope the politicians get it. Mm. But that is a real risk, is that the regulation swings too far in one direction. And then the other big one, of course, from a housing perspective is just interest rates. Mm. We are not believers that Australia's interest rates moving up anytime soon. Mm. While the economy just kind of continues to muddle along, wage growth is very stagnant. Underemployment's a real challenge. And we don't think that Australia's in a position to be lifting rates. But at the same time, the U.S. is clearly lifting rates. I mean, the 10-year is the highest it's been in a long time. And, if the sort of global benchmark rate that is the U.S. starts to lift rates in other developed economies, Australia could get pulled up into that, even if the cash rate doesn't increase. So that's a real risk as well. Our base case is that things will be generally fine, probably a little slower on the housing front, but that's not necessarily so bad. And in fact, we think the banks actually look like reasonable value right now. We're fans of Westpac, for instance. It's one of our top picks. All four major banks we have wide economic moat ratings on. Mm-hmm. Pricing power and switching costs are just enormous for the Australian banks, which we think is great for investors. And, the Royal Commission that's been going on, of course, we're going to see what exactly happens from all of that. But we think the banks are well placed from a capital ratio perspective, certainly from a cash flow perspective. And frankly, we think the market is pricing that in at this point.
Okay, awesome. So I mentioned international as well. You guys have had a slightly bearish outlook globally for, 12, 18 months, something like that. Talk me through that one.
Yeah, you're right. So it's interesting if you look at, in particular, the S&P 500, and you we cover about 1,500 stocks globally from a qualitative perspective, we cover about half of those in the U.S. Mm-hmm. So we cover a very large portion of the U.S. market. And if you kind of roll up our fair value estimates that each of our analysts are producing, compare that to the aggregate price of the market, only until very, very recently, we would have said, things are looking overheated. Mm-hmm. We would have said that the price of the U.S. market looked, in some cases, upwards of 8 or 9% overvalued, which it hadn't looked that overvalued in almost 10 years.
10 years ago was an interesting time, right? So it's...
yes, that's right.
That's quite alarming, that timing.
Yes, it has come back a little bit. Mm. And actually now, based on some of the pullback we've seen in the U.S. and the fact that, again, shareholders should expect returns, so our fair value should go up over time. Mm. Again, when you see in the quantitative valuation ratio fairly valued, we don't mean that, or 3 stars if you're looking at the qualitative research, we don't mean that this is going to be flat forever. We mean that you're getting a reasonable rate of return for the price you're paying.
Yep.
As the stock market has come back a little bit and we've kind of fast-forwarded through time, we're now seeing the market as very slightly undervalued in the U.S. It's a slightly different story than what we see in Australia. Mm-hmm. In Australia, we see it as, on average, slightly overvalued still. A big part of that, again, is our view on the large miners here in Australia. Mm-hmm. If you look at the median stock we cover, so just take the one that's smack dab right in the middle, that actually is about fairly valued.
Okay.
For us, the ASX 200 is probably offering reasonable value, a bit less now that it's bounced back in the last month or two, but cautiously optimistic, I would say, at this point.
And slightly better value if you go just industrials, right?
That's right.
So I was going to say, let's get specific. Where would you recommend local investors look for value right now, effectively outside the big miners? You've talked about the banks being reasonably fair value, let's call them fair value, and that for our investors is something that will make them very happy because they are heavily overweight financials, particularly our retiree and SMSF investors. You've talked about Invacare as a stock you really like, which is great. Anything else that you would want to leave people with?
Yeah, I think there's lots of different examples. For us, we get really excited when we compare the quality of a business, those sort of narrow and wide economic moats with a stock that looks undervalued.
Mm.
A star rating of 4 or 5, I think the quant ratings actually use words like undervalued.
Yes, it's very clear.
Yes, exactly. and there are a number of those, in the Australian market that, I'd probably leave folks with.
Mm-hmm.
Another one in sort of the counter trend, if you will, would be Bapcor.
Mm-hmm.
So this is another name that maybe doesn't get talked about too much, but this is an auto parts retailer, the Burson's Auto Parts Stores.
Mm-hmm.
All we hear about in retail is Amazon.
Yeah.
Absolutely decimating electronics retailers, clothing retailers. You see Audi coming in, really hurting Woolworths and Kohl's margins.
Mm-hmm.
It's very difficult to compete online in the auto parts world. Service, timeliness, location, often very rare parts that are needed for random vehicles that might come in.
Mm.
But Bapcor's been swept up in that.
Mm.
And we remain pretty optimistic that this is a business that is more insulated from e-commerce. This is a business that we think has a narrow economic moat. So we talked about wide economic moats being 20 years plus. Not quite as confident there.
Mm.
But 10 years is still a very long time to be earning excess returns. And for us, it's an opportunity to buy a pretty high quality business at a really attractive price.
Awesome. Adam, the fantastic thing about your research, and thank you for giving really specific examples, people can go and find those examples, read more about them on the NABTrade site where it's freely available to anyone who is in any way subscribed to our services. Those are really explicit guides and they're fantastic, but you have a heap of other insights and research available for people. Where would they go to find that?
Yeah, absolutely. Our main website here in Australia is morningstar.com.au.
It's fairly simple, yeah.
Very simple. You're right, we have everything from overarching market commentary to news articles. We have guest writers that come in, and then we have stock-specific discussions and valuations as well. Of course, some of that is freely available. Some of that is through our premium service.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not just stocks. We cover managed funds, we cover ETFs, cover LICs. And it's really a pretty wide range of commentary that we put through that website.
Awesome. Adam, thank you so much for your time.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
To those of you listening, thank you so much for tuning in to this episode of Your Wealth. It's been fantastic to have you. We always love to hear from you. So if you have any feedback or suggestions for future topics, please just email us at yourwealth@nab.com.au. I'm Gemma Dale. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for listening to Your Wealth with Gemma Dale. To stay up to date, please subscribe to this podcast series or email us at yourwealth@nab.com.au.
Please note that any advice provided in this podcast has been prepared without taking into account your objectives, financial circumstances, or needs. Before acting, you should consider the appropriateness of the information. To find out more, please visit nab.com.au.